To open up the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resource on 26th of March. First, we have a bill number, House Bill 2783, and I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2783. Would you read the bill, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2783 creates the offense of unlawful tethering of a domestic animal in a person's custody or control and establishes that that offense is a Class B violation. It specifies unlawful tethering if a person tethers a domestic animal in that person's custody or control, one, in the location not free of obstructions that would cause strangulation, two, with tether less than 15 feet in length, three, with a collar that pinches or chokes the animal when pulled, or four, for more than 5 hours in a 24-hour period, or for more than 10 hours in a 24-hour period if tether is attached to a zip line. It exempts veterinary facilities or persons transporting domestic animals. It establishes that a person does not commit the offense of tethering the animal if the animal remains in the physical presence of the person or the animal is tethered, one, pursuant to requirements of campground or recreation facility, two, to engage in activity that requires licensure, or three, protects that animal from an activity related to cultivating or harvesting agricultural or forest products. It specifies that a person commits the crime of animal neglect in the first degree if a person tethers the domestic animal and tethering results in serious injury or death to that animal. It specifies that the person commits the crime of animal neglect in the second degree if a person tethers the domestic animal and the tethering results in physical injury to the animal. There is a -3 amendment that revises the list of criteria in Section 2 of the bill. It would specify that unlawful tethering exists if a person tethers a domestic animal in the person's custody or control, one, if the tether is not a reasonable length given the size of the animal and available space and allows the animal to become entangled, two, with a collar that pinches or chokes the animal when pulled, or three, for more than 10 hours in a 24-hour period or for more than 15 hours in a 24-hour period if tether is attached to a running line, pulley, or trolley system. The -3 also has a couple more small changes, including if a dog is kept for herding or protective livestock or dog sledding, and it provides that hunting is an example of an activity that requires licensure.
Thank you. First up, we have, of course, our chair, Representative Witt.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Brad Witt, state representative from House District 31, appearing before you this morning in support of House Bill 2783, and there is a -3 amendment to this bill. The genesis of the bill. I am an avid hunter and fisher and someone who also loves animals, and that possible contradiction is perhaps best understood, maybe only understood, by those who engage in those activities. This is a third bill that I have sponsored to protect animals, and successfully worked through this process with the help of my legislative colleagues here in this building. The first bill was last session, and it prevented the finning of sharks, and I'm proud to say that that movement that started here in this building has gone global, and in fact within the last half year the country of People's Republic of China has also virtually banned globally now. The second bill, which you are familiar with, was large woody debris, which this committee dealt with here a couple of weeks ago, and dealt with a critical habitat for salmonids. And House Bill 2783, the third bill in that series, intended to provide some protection for our best friends. I have been extremely fortunate to have owned three absolutely superior bird hunting dogs. People say that if you get one in a lifetime, you're lucky. I am extremely lucky and fortunate to have had that. I would have to admit that I've had other dogs that were not quite so well performing. I had one that, in fact, at the sound of a gunshot, ended up in the next county before it stopped. But I love them all. They were all great pets in addition, and that's why I decided to sponsor this bill. Initially, the bill came out of Legislative Council far more aggressive than I had intended or would have preferred. And so when we met as a group back in January, prior to the beginning of the legislature, I asked that an informal work group be formed to work this bill out and to make it one that would work in reality, that would protect dogs, but also not end up getting people running afoul of the law for unintended actions. During that committee's work, I stayed away from the process, and I did so on the on the sage advice that my my father had once given me, which in essence said that when you ask a man to do a job, and please understand that in my father's day of work and in the work setting in which he worked, it was a man's world of work. But he said when you ask a man to do a job, you give him the ability to complete the task. And it has, in fact, been advice that has served me well over a number of decades. And I allowed the committee to do its work. And they came back with recommendations that the LC Legislative Council turned into the Dash 1 amendments. Subsequent to that, there have been a number of discussions, particularly within the hunting community, that they wanted additional assurances that when folks engage in the training, the trialing, and in fact the hunting of dogs, that somehow they not be accused of illegal tethering. The Dash 3 amendments goes just a little bit further than what the Dash 1 amendments did. And on line 22 of the first page of the bill, it says, quote-unquote, including but not limited to hunting. So these folks would be excluded from violations under the Act. And I want to state for the legislative history and for the record that this is precisely the intent of this bill and that it is in no way intended to adversely impact the hunting community. And with that, Mr. Chairman, and with the Dash 3 amendments, to the best of my knowledge, there is no opposition to this bill. The Dash 3 amendments, I believe, have brought most everyone, at least no one has come to me to indicate their opposition to the bill. And with that, I would point out that there will be people following me that were actually involved in the work group. It included animal lovers, animal protectionists. It included a lot of people from the law enforcement community who can, if you have questions about the actual process and what went into their amendments, are better situated than I to answer your questions, but I open myself to them.
Any questions?
You can't let him off that easy. I guess you got all that off easy.
Thank you very much.
Oh, yeah. Scott Beckstead, Randy Covey, and Glenn Kolb. Is that correct, Glenn Kolb?
We haven't seen him yet.
Okay. Okay, we got everyone except Glenn.
Okay. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning.
Morning.
Please proceed.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Scott Beckstead, Senior Oregon Director for the Humane Society of the United States. The Humane Society of the United States is the nation's largest animal protection organization. We are headquartered in Washington, D.C., and I'm fortunate in, to be the director of their affairs here in the state of Oregon. I live in North Douglas County. I'm a constituent of Representative Bruce Hanna, and I am also the owner of four dogs, although considering how much harder I work for them than they work for me, I'd say it's probably more accurate to say that they own me. As Representative Witt explained, the bill before you, including the Dash 3 amendments, is the product of a great deal of good faith work on the part of a number of organizations that came together for the best interests of the dogs, but also for the best interests of law enforcement and animal control officers who are charged with the responsibility of responding to dog-related complaints. As a result, that coalition that is here to support this bill includes not just the Humane Society of the United States, but also the Oregon Humane Society, the Oregon Animal Control Council, the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, Fences for Fido, Multnomah County, and Washington County. The fact is that a chained dog is an unhappy dog, and 80% of the dog-related complaints that law enforcement has to respond to, whether it's dogs barking incessantly, or dogs being aggressive, or dogs biting, or dogs running at large, or dogs being badly neglected, involve dogs that are living their lives at the end of a chain. This bill is designed to address the chronically chained dog and the host of problems that they present to the community. The bill sets reasonable time limits on the amount of the number of hours per day that a dog can spend at the end of a chain. It lists offenses and penalties. Unlawful tethering is a Class B violation. Unlawful tethering that results in physical injury to the dog is a Class B misdemeanor, and unlawful tethering that results in serious physical injury or death to the dog is a Class A misdemeanor. The purpose here, of course, is to give law enforcement an additional tool to deal with chronically chained dogs, to encourage people to bring their dogs into the family, make them part of the family, and address the problems that these animals can create, as well as, of course, their welfare and their health and safety. There are some important exemptions to the statute. It's not unlawful to tether your dog if you're in the dog's physical presence, if you're out camping, if you're engaging in hunting activities, if you're transporting the dog, or if the dog is being used to herd livestock, protect livestock, or are dogs kept for dog sledding. The bill also sets some important minimum care standards to clarify what has been a very vague and difficult to interpret statute regarding what kind of housing is required for dogs that are kept outside. This bill clarifies, adds some additional detail to make the job easier for animal control officers, and I know that they're going to explain that to you later. But with that, members of the committee, Chair Witt, we thank you very much for taking the time to consider this important bill. We believe that it is carefully tailored to address a specific problem, that there will not be any unintended consequences, and that the dogs and the animal control officers of Oregon will be much better for it. Thank you very much for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Who's next?
Chairman Witt, members of the committee, my name is Randall B. Covey. I'm the Field Services Supervisor for Washington County Animal Services, based in Hillsboro, Oregon, and I'm here today representing Washington County in support of House Bill 2783 and the Dash 3 Amendment. I'm also here representing the Oregon Animal Control Council. As a current member and past president of that organization, I've been asked to also represent the OACC in support of this bill and the Dash 3 Amendment. As field enforcement officer and as a supervisor over the past 25 years, I've had occasion to deal with dogs tethered out on many occasions. I've also supervised many officers in the field and had to offer them advice and guidance in how to address these types of situations. House Bill 2783 and the Dash 3 Amendment contain language that will help field officers address many complaints from concerned neighbors, friends, and even relatives of dog owners that own dogs that are left out unsupervised and tethered. Leaving them out in these conditions often results in neglect, and that neglect results in animals with serious skin conditions like dermatitis caused by flea infestations and allergies, and injuries like collars embedded in the neck that go undetected because the animals are left out unsupervised and unchecked for long periods of time. I've also had the privilege of having been commissioned by both Governor Kitzhaber in his first terms and by Governor Kulongoski as a special agent charged with enforcing the criminal animal welfare laws of the state of Oregon. And in that position, I also had occasion to deal with specifically the neglect laws in the state of Oregon. And while we do have some of the best laws in the nation, this bill will help make them better and give field officers the tools that they need to address the tethering issues that so often come up. So again, I know there are others waiting to testify, so I'm not going to take a long time, but on behalf of the Oregon Animal Control Council and Washington County Animal Services, I urge you to support this bill and the Dash 3 Amendment, and I'm happy to answer questions now or after other testimony.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Well, good morning, Chair Witt, committee members. My name is Glenn Kolb. I'm executive director with the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. I apologize for my tardiness this morning. It seemed to be time challenged a little bit. When the bill was first introduced, our board took a look at it, and we did have some reservations about it. We had reservations, some about the maybe more specific, what we thought were restrictions of the bill. We weren't opposed to the intent and the idea behind it. We were fortunately were asked to participate in a working group, and we had a discussion on this, and as we discussed more and more about the merits of the bill, some of the language was modified and certainly softened, and we support that. I think it's important to note that the most significant changes and suggestions came from the very organizations and individuals who were out in the field day by day to address animal care standards, and that's law enforcement agencies. And so when we saw that, we pledged our support behind this. The legislation doesn't sell somebody that they have to socialize or interact with their dog. It doesn't say they even have to like their dog. But what it does say is that there's some additional parameters about good standards of care that you're going to have to meet. And we believe in those standards of care. We see that in the veterinary profession all the time. And really, we see this as modest upgrades to our animal welfare laws, and it's going to give our law enforcement agencies some clearer definitions so when they're in the field, they can have those conversations with individuals who either are intentionally or unintentionally failing to meet minimum care standards. And for those reasons, we support House Bill 2783-3 amendments.
Thank you very, very much. Questions or comments for this panel? Yes, Representative Reardon.
I'm just curious how prevalent this problem is. Is there, and if it can, if a lot of it is just ignorance on the part of the owner, or can you just characterize it a little bit for me?
Well, these two are looking at me, so I guess I'll take that question. Chairman Witt,
please.
Representative Reardon. It's a good question, and the answer is that at times it seems like it happens often. And granted, there are other times where we don't get calls of this nature very much. But when it does occur, is when we need the tools to address it. I would say, if I had to put a number on it, I would say maybe in Washington County, two or three calls a month, and there are other months where there's no calls at all. Education is often very effective, but the reason for having a good law is that you can educate around it, and when people fail to respond to that education, then you have the tool to address it appropriately.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further? Yes, Representative Krieger, please.
I'm trying to recall, there's something in the game code regarding allowing dogs to run at large during certain seasons of the year when game birds are being hatched. Do you recall that? It's there, I just can't remember specifically whether we'd be running afoul requiring someone to have their dog not tethered if they can't have it in the house and it's loose and it's adjacent to those areas. I'd have some concerns a little bit about that. Also, we have a couple dogs, and they're located underneath trees for shade in the summer. Even on the coast, we're talking, because we're up off the beach quite a ways, 85, 90 degrees is common. Well, to get them away from where they might entangle, I'd have to have them out with full light to the sun, unless I got them underneath a carport or a doghouse in a place like that. So I have a little concern with that part of it. So those are two issues I think we need to address.
Okay. Chairman Witt, Representative Krieger, I'll try to remember the two or three different points there. First of all, the issue of the game birds and the hunting. I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with the game regulations of the state of Oregon. My expertise is in the animal welfare laws and the criminal laws and the county codes that relate to animal welfare. But I do know that this bill with the -3 amendments addresses people that are engaged in lawful hunting practices and or licensed hunting practices. In regards to the time limits and the issue of providing tethering animals where they have access to shade, I don't think that this bill restricts that. I think it actually encourages people to do things like you do, which is to monitor the tethering of your dog and make sure that they are adequately protected from the sun and other weather. Sometimes in the summer it's the sun, in the winter it's the cold and the rain. And it simply requires people to pay attention to their animals, as you clearly do with yours.
Additional questions or comments? Not seeing any. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank
appreciate
you.
Your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to call up, please, Sharon Harmon, Mike Oswald, and Wendy Ramers, please. Welcome to each of you.
Good morning.
Please determine your order of testimony and proceed. I see the elbows.
Good morning.
Good morning.
First, good morning, Chair Witt and committee members. I am Mike Oswald. I am the director of Multnomah County Animal Services. We're the public animal service agency serving Portland and all the cities in Multnomah County, including the rural areas and unincorporated areas. Animal services organizations and animal control organizations across the state are responsible for enforcing local ordinances and state laws related to animal ownership and animal welfare. Sadly, animal abuse and neglect continue to be a problem throughout the state, in both urban areas and in rural areas. Last year alone in Multnomah County, our officers investigated nearly 700 cases of animal neglect and abuse, and of those, 106 of them were related to tethering and tethering violations. A typical case that involves tethering comes from a call from a concerned neighbor who sees a dog that's tied, often too short of a leash, has no access to food or water, sometimes has to lie in its own excrement, is not protected from the elements, maybe has a doghouse, maybe doesn't have a doghouse. It could be in good repair, might be too small. Oftentimes they're in jeopardy, and animal welfare is a real issue, and people are concerned. Neighbors are concerned. Pet owners are concerned. This bill, House Bill 2783, will provide some clear language and definitions around what would become lawful tethering, with limits of time, limits on lengths of tethering, the kind of conditions in which animals are tethered. It provides needed definitions within the statutes for adequate shelter, adequate bedding, things of that nature, which help officers who are out investigating these cases. I can speak real briefly to the experience we have in Multnomah County. In the mid-90s, the Board of County Commissioners adopted ordinance that regulates tethering activity in really two practices. One is the length of time dogs can be on a tether, and also the conditions in which they're tethered, which may become a danger or a jeopardy to the life of the animal in the way in which they're tethered. And in those particular cases, it gives officers the authority, and it gives them real clear language within the ordinance, which is enforceable, and also gives them the ability to rescue dogs in situations which are life-threatening for them. In the last 8 years under this ordinance, we've had 44 successful cases where violations have been enforced and dozens of dogs have been rescued. The adoption of House Bill 2783 will enable animal control officers, animal services officers, law enforcement officials from around the state to conduct timely animal welfare investigations, and that will improve the care and welfare of dogs, and oftentimes can literally mean the difference between life and death for a dog that's tethered. This proposed language really does create an educational tool for enforcement, because it defines what's responsible on the part of a dog owner. It's enforceable from a law enforcement perspective, and it's humane. So I would be glad to offer any other comments or answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate that. What we'll do is we'll go through the panel, and then we'll ask questions of you as a group. Good morning.
Good morning, Representative Witt, members of the committee. My name is Sharon Harmon. I am the executive director of the Oregon Humane Society. We are not affiliated with any other local or national group. We're an independent animal agency serving the state of Oregon through a variety of services. Certainly one of those is animal welfare enforcement. We really appreciate the efforts of this committee to put forth this bill, and we think the Dash 3 amendments are a reasonable accommodation while clarifying that the impact is not unintended consequences. Representative Krieger, you mentioned that, what are people to do if they can't tie up their dog? I guess my response is that people have both choice and responsibility for the care of their animals. We live in rural Columbia County in Representative Witt's district, and my family has hunting dogs. And I tell you, wire hair pointers are not an animal that's easily confined. We had a zip line, and that was the only way to keep those two dogs on the property when we were at work. But when we were home, we had a choice, and those dogs came in the house. And I think from the dog's perspective, dogs are pack animals. They want to be part of the family. They want to do their best to serve and protect. They want to be there when there's an intruder. They want to know what's for dinner. They want to know where the cat's going. They want to be part of the family, and living a life outdoors 24 hours a day and often substandard conditions. Yes, we have minimum care standards to address it, but when you look at the circumstances, and I'll let Investigator Reimers discuss her personal experience with those circumstances. It's deplorable, and the state of Oregon has a long legacy of animal protection, and we'd like to see tethering banned for 24 hours at a time. The other side of it, we've talked about animal welfare, but I also want to bring up public safety. When dogs behave really badly, it's often associated with being chained 24 hours a day. So I thought, well, I'll look it up when I prepared for testimony 2 weeks ago or a week ago about what's the incidence of dog bite fatalities. I didn't have to go far. I had to go back to all the way to March 9th to look at a circumstance where a dog had killed a child. 24-hour chain, child came up to the Rottweiler, child dies. When you look at the circumstances involving really horrific animal attacks on people, often the frustration of being tied 24 hours a day. We don't know if those animals were tied because they were aggressive, but it certainly enhances that innate dangerous element. For human safety, for animal welfare, we'd appreciate your support of House Bill 2783. I've also submitted testimony on behalf of Emily Davidson. She is a staff attorney with our cruelty division. She hears the cases. She prepares the reports for district attorneys. She could not be here today, but she wanted to make sure her testimony is on the record. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Welcome. Good morning, Representative Witt and the committee. My name is Wendy Reimer. I'm a humane investigator with the Oregon Humane Society. When the investigations department at the Oregon Humane Society receives a report of animal neglect or unlawful tethering, I'm dispatched to go to these residents to check on food, water, proper shelter, and the well-being of the pet. More times than not, I get there and the dogs are tethered or chained to short leashes, underneath boats, underneath dilapidated cars. They have open wounds, open sores, in need of medical care. They have no proper shelter, no food, and no water. And they're basically just left out in the yard and not cared for. I would have to say on a weekly basis, I attend 5 to 6 homes a day where tethering is an issue. I'd like to point out one case in particular is that we had a female dog named Angel, which was a pit bull. She was chained on a 4-foot wide run that was covered inches in feces and urine that she lived in on a daily basis until we found her and received a complaint. The wounds were raw and oozing with infection. There was no way for her. She did have a shelter, but there was no way for her to get out of that. So with that open wounds and the infection, it was all getting in there together. Angel's owner were cited and convicted of animal neglect in the first degree, and she was adopted by a local prosecutor. It's odd to think of Angel as lucky, but sadly, the story is repeated in so many cases that we see. Often, more tragic endings. Countless calls flow through our office about tethered dogs. Unfortunately, I feel that a lot of it is education with the dog owners. They need to know what they need to do to protect their dogs. And this will give us the tool to help those dogs. I would like to, Representative Witt, Representative Reardon, I'd like to comment on the your question from the last panel. It's not uncommon when I travel statewide weekly to see dogs that are tethered to short chains, that are on chains that are so heavy, that are weighing down their neck, that are so short that literally they have a 2 to 3 foot circumference to walk around in. And yes, they do get aggressive at that short end of that chain. They have no socialization. They have nowhere to go. They basically sit in that one spot. I urge you, as a humane investigator with the Oregon Humane Society, and for other animal control officers in this state, and law enforcement officers, to support House Bill 2783 and the amendment, the Dash 3 amendment. That way it gives me a better tool to help protect them.
Thank you very, very much. Appreciate all of your testimonies. Do we have questions, committee members of this panel? Representative Reardon, please.
Chair Witt, thank you. Just curious, when you find a dog that is tethered, what are some of the alternatives that are offered to a person? Is there a certain size cage that is acceptable, or does it have to be in a closed yard, or what are some of the better alternatives to?
Well, certainly we recommend that they come in the house. Yeah. That's the best alternative. If they're not able to do that, then certainly, you know, a kennel that gives them plenty of room for exercise, as well as provide adequate shelter and bedding for them. So I've seen people, for instance, put them in a 10-by-10 kennel, which is acceptable for a smaller dog. But when you have these larger dogs, they certainly need more room to move around. The other option is tethering, putting them on a zip line, which gives them more room to move. And the other thing that would be acceptable would be fences for Fido. If they don't have the resources to put up a fence, then we certainly do refer to fences for Fido to help these dogs and these families.
Thank you. Additional questions or comments? I'm seeing none. Thank you very, very much for your testimony. Next, I'd like to call up, please, Michelle Blake, Kelly Peterson, and Sue Hubline, please.
Does that finish our balance?
Yeah. Good morning. Welcome to our committee. If I could please ask that you summarize your testimony to the best extent possible, because we have a number of bills that we have behind us here.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure. Chair Witt and committee members, my name is Kelly Peterson, and many of you know me as working for the Humane Society of the United States. Today, though, I'm here on behalf of the founder and president of Fences for Fido. And I thank you so much for allowing us to testify in support of House Bill 2783. Fences for Fido, it was referenced earlier, we are an all-volunteer nonprofit, and we build free fences for families who have dogs living outside on the ends of chains. We also provide insulated dog houses. We build them from scratch. And we provide critical spay and neuter and veterinary services, and it's all for free. You had asked a little bit about how prevalent it is. We started our organization less than 4 years ago, and we've built fences for more than 550 dogs in Oregon and Southwest Washington. We're primarily in the Tri-County area in Willamette Valley, but we've gone as far as Christmas Valley. We've gone to Walport, Newport, Madras, Hood River, the Dalles, Newport, Sweet Home. We build on average 8 to 10 fences a month. We have about 20 dogs on our waiting list at all times. We find our clients one of three ways. Oftentimes families apply themselves. They know about Fences for Fido. They are referred from animal control. They apply themselves. The other way is neighbors, passerbys, maybe other family members that don't live part of that household. And lastly, we find out from animal control and local humane societies. We have good, close partnerships with them. And it is true, it's hard to summarize. I could spend here all day, but I won't sit down here all day. It is, you know, dogs that are chained are a public safety threat. We are called, it's not uncommon to be called from animal services, asking us to build a fence for a dog who has been on a chain, but often gets off the chain and menaces the neighborhood, chasing down, you know, smaller animals, cats. It's not uncommon for them to have injured them. And we come in, we build a fence, and it's amazing. The neighbor disputes decrease. And that's another benefit. We build, you know, 6-foot fences. We do ground wire, so there's no escape. These dogs that can be dangerous, we want to ensure that they're fully behind a fence. Lastly, I also wanted to talk a little bit about the psychological and behavioral issues with these dogs on chains. We have a foster care program. We've maybe rehomed 50 dogs. We never thought we would necessarily have a foster care program. But when we approach families about a free fence, most of them are all very welcoming. Sometimes for whatever reason, they realize that even if they have a fence, they still can't meet the dog's needs. So we bring the dog into our program. It's taxing. It's not easy to place dogs that have been on the end of chains. It takes a lot of, we put them in foster care, a lot of socialization. But we simply just couldn't build enough fences to solve the problem. We see this law. We know our families very well. We have long-term relationships with our families. We visit them once a year. And it's really a minimum standard in terms of this bill. And our families, I believe Oregonians, could make accommodations pretty easily without it being too much of a hardship. We're just asking them that when they can find their animals, when they put them on a chain or a zip line, they do it with, and they're deliberate, and they think about it, and that they do it in a way that doesn't endanger the dog. And I think with that, I want to let two other people say a few things, but I thank you for your time.
Good morning, Chair Witt and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Blake, and one of the founding board members of Fences for Fido, along with my friend Kelly, and I currently serve as the co-chair of the board of Fences for Fido. And I wanted to just speak a little bit about some of the public safety and health concerns associated with chaining, because at this point, Fences for Fido has unchained over 500 dogs. We always have dogs on our waiting list. From our perspective, this is such a widespread problem and so prevalent that we could work every weekend for the next 20 years and never catch up with the numbers of dogs who are languishing on chains in substandard conditions, unless we do something collectively at the state level to address the conditions and ask something more of these families. So to speak to the public safety issue, as has been mentioned, touched on before in testimony this morning, the Centers for Disease Control says that chain dogs are 2.8 times more likely to bite. And when you're talking about bites on small children, that increases exponentially. They're about 5.4 times more likely to bite children. Doing my outreach work with Fences for Fido, I was on the receiving end of one of those bites, actually got sent to the hospital. I was just stunned by the power and the strength of a scared dog, and could not help but think about how much more devastating that could have been if I had been a smaller, younger person. These dogs really are absolutely terrified, and the short tether takes away their flight response and leaves only fight. And these dogs actually do become quite dangerous. And as Kelly mentioned, when we take in these dogs, some of the behavior and health issues that have resulted from their long-term chaining are just so costly and time-consuming to address. I picked up a dog last week named Chloe, had been chained for several years out in Staten, about a 4-foot chain. And so her life was so tiny. This was an absolutely terrified dog who is a bite risk, who is so fearful that people are afraid of, if she'll be dangerous. So I have learned some amazing tricks. They involve $1 bacon burgers at Burger King with a little tranquilizer stuffed in the middle, and hand it to the dog and wait for her to get sleepy and take her in the car. And so this dog is going to undergo her long rehabilitation period with training and anxiety medications. And, how many dogs can you invest that much in? And I also have one of them who actually slept on my bed last night, which doesn't get to happen a lot because she snores. But she was chained for a very long time to an RV up in Northeast Salem. It took the family over a year to decide that they wanted anything done with the dog. They thought that all that long-term chaining was fine. They wanted her chained. They didn't want a fence. And her skin issues, her behavior issues, took her a year and a half in foster care before I finally adopted her. So we see the behavior issues, we see the medical issues, and for a lot of these families, it's only a matter of a broken gate or a few feet of fences. You would be surprised how often it only takes a minor fence repair or some minor adjustment to the yard to create a safe, confined space for the dog and eliminate the chaining. So in a lot of cases, we're not asking for a major change from the family, but we are creating a major change for the dog and quite a bit of more health and safety for the community. So we ask you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Witt and committee. I am Sue Hublin, and I live in rural Malala in Clackamas County, and I'm a volunteer with Fences for Fido. One of the reasons I volunteer for Fences for Fido is when I was a young girl back in the 60s, we had a black lab mix named Inky, and he was a nice dog, and he was a member of our family, but he lived on a chain in the very far corner of a pretty big yard, about half an acre yard back then. And that was his life in the back of the yard. One time a neighbor dog got loose and kind of ravaged the neighborhood, and Inky was pretty beat up because that dog came and fought with him. The next door neighbor's dog, which was also chained, a golden retriever, ended up with a broken leg from a dog fight with that dog. What happened to Inky? When I was about 5 years old, I slipped down there when my mom was hanging clothes out on the line, and unfortunately she had just given Inky something to eat, and I got too close and he bit me. And that was a death sentence for him. He went, and that was the end of him. And so I try to help people have better relationships with their dogs. So why in this day and age do people chain their dogs? Well, you can, generations before, and people learn from their parents, their families, and they don't always think about alternatives until somebody presents an alternative to them, or the state passes a law that says, we're better than that now. You can walk into any hardware store, and it's totally legal to buy any kind of chaining system that you want, but it's really no life for the dogs. We know that now. We know they need socialization, that they need connection. They need the basics of food and shelter that's not going to get water that's not going to get knocked over by their chain. They need to be able to get away from bees if they're chained by a bush and the bush is flowering because it's the springtime. It's difficult to do anything well for a dog when it's tethered on a very short line. And as others have mentioned, the dog feels exposed, they feel vulnerable, they feel trapped, they feel abandoned.
Could you please summarize?
I will, yes, thank you. And so it's good for the dog to get off the chain, and Fences for Fido is there to help people do that. It's good for the family because they connect with their animal. The neighborhood, you've heard about the barking. It's good for the community. It's safer. The dog is in the house or behind a fence and not available to small children to get close to it. So let me just summarize now so that if there are questions, you can ask them.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your summarization. Any questions or comments for this panel? I'm seeing none. Thank you very, very much. And with that, I am going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 2783. We'll come back to that. We had a little more testimony than we thought we were going to have. And I am going to open a public hearing on House Bills 2319, 2715, and 2736. And welcome, Representative Buckley. Would like to everyone to know that if we don't finish testimony on this bill today, that we're going to continue testimony at a later time. Welcome to each of you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Members of the committee. Representative Peter Buckley, representing the South Jackson County Legislature. Mr. Chair, my apologies. I cleared my schedule from 8 to 9 to be here for the bills in communication with my office and committee administrator. I do have to leave at 9. I'm not going to be able to stay to listen to testimony. In addition, we do have a number of people that traveled to be here a great distance, so I'm hoping they will receive the same courtesy, the people who testified on the previous bill in terms of their ability to testify at length terms of their...
Representative Buckley, I apologize. I thought your schedule was cleared until 10. My apologies, sir.
Very good. Well, I appreciate that. Colleagues, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, imagine in your district a company started back in 1974, now grown to the point where it has $30 million in sales each year close to it, is patronized and treasured by thousands of constituents, and is responsible for hundreds of jobs in your community and your region. Now, you would, I'm sure, colleagues, want to do everything you possibly could to make sure that company continues to expand and to thrive. I have such a company in Ashland, the Ashland Food Co-op, and you have before you, I believe, written testimony from their manager, Annie Hoy, documenting the growth of the company and its direct dependence on growing, on the growing successful organic farming industry in our region. I can also point to Amy's Kitchen, located in the Rogue Valley, one of the largest employers we have in Jackson County. Amy's Kitchen sells their frozen organic food across the country, and they recently announced their decision to expand their operations in our valley to add hundreds of more jobs. And the primary reason for their expansion is access to organic crops. That's why I'm here before you today. I believe the economic future of my district and my region is at stake. I hope you'll take time to read Annie Hoy's letter, and I'm grateful that you're taking time to listen to testimony on these three bills. I'll also be providing you a list of support of dozens of local farmers and local restaurants from the Rogue Valley who believe our economic future is at stake. Two of the bills before you, House Bill 2319 and House Bill 2736, are right-to-farm bills. House Bill 2319 deals with the right of a farmer to grow her or his crops free from contamination of GMO crops. It applies to farms in existence prior to GMO farming nearby, which I know is a concern to my colleague from Medford, who was there first to front. House Bill 2736 deals with the right of a farmer to be free from liability should GMO seeds be found on his or her farm through no action or choice of their own. Now, both of these bills deal with issues of basic fairness, and I ask the committee to work them and send them for a vote on the floor. The third bill, House Bill 2715, goes right to the heart of my opening statement. It clarifies in statute the ability of a local government to regulate GMO crops. I need to take a moment to make sure it's clear what I'm talking about here. I'm not talking about crops that have been cross-pollinated or are hybrid. GMO crops are those where genes from one or more entirely different species are used to change a natural crop. Genes from a shark, for instance, used in tomatoes to produce tougher bruise-resistant skins. That's the type of crops we're talking about, genetically modified crops, not cross-pollinated, not hybrid crops. In a sense, we're asking the committee to endorse and back traditional farming methods and to move slowly on new farming methods of questionable value, of potential danger, both in regard to health and our local economy. Now, you've heard testimony in your committee earlier this session that I believe to be inaccurate, and a review of the facts will bear that out. You've heard that regulations on GMO are unconstitutional, yet a number of counties, including the most recently put in place ban by San Juan County in Washington State, have been passed and not found to be unconstitutional, including the ban in Mendocino County in California that has stood since 2004. You've heard that if you allow a local ban to be voted on in Jackson County, there'll be huge legal costs to fight the challenge. There is no evidence that I can find that any county has borne extraordinary legal costs following a ban. And we have legal expertise from the Center of Food Safety here with us today to answer any questions you have on the legal issues. But I want to make just a couple comments about democracy and about the Rogue Valley. First, if I can permission to use this word, sir.
Please do.
This is a map of the Rogue Valley, which will cover up our legal... You can see this is a small sample of the organic farms in the Rogue Valley. The Rogue Valley, Senator Bates put this in testimony...
If you'd like to hold that paper up to the side, that would be fine.
All right. Over there.
Thank you very much.
As Senator Bates mentioned in his testimony on the Senate side on these issues, the Rogue Valley is a narrow valley, mountains on four sides with a river running through it. When people talk about, well, you can just do buffer zones, the Rogue Valley is not wide enough to have buffer zones. We need to make a decision. Are we going to have the Rogue Valley be famous for organic farming, organic crops, which we have the reputation for now, and we have thriving business based on it? Or are we going to have the Rogue Valley be a valley and an agricultural community that uses GMO crops instead? Unless we pass the bill before it's clarifying that Jackson County has a right to vote on this issue, you are making a decision. You're making the decision that GMO crops will increase in the Rogue Valley over the next several years. Just a couple words about democracy. The people in Jackson County have done this the way we always asked them to do. They focused on an issue, they discussed the issue, they held meetings on the issue, they came up with a proposal, they gathered the signatures to place that issue on the ballot in front of the voters. It's due to go on the ballot in May of 2014. We're asking you today to consider the bill that clarifies that county's right to regulate GMOs, that clarifies our right to have a say in our economic future. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Buckley. I know you have to go here very shortly, and I apologize for the mix-up. Committee members, does anyone have any questions for Representative Buckley before he has to leave? Thank you very, very much. Right. Who's next?
Hi, my name is Brian Combs. Thanks for letting me be here. I live in Ashland, Oregon. I've been there for 3 years. I'm also the chief petitioner for Measure 15-119, a ban on GMO crops in Jackson County, and I was going to address you on some issues related to the three bills before us. I wanted to elaborate real quick on the map that was held up, just so we can put it back to sleep, so to speak. But that the Bear Creek watershed is 8 miles across, peak to peak. When a foreign corporation was growing sugar beets under permit from USDA APHIS, they had a requirement of the permit to stay 4 miles away from other conventional seed growers. That what you see there, the dark area across the map diagonally, is the width of the Bear Creek Valley, 8 miles peak to peak. The circles you see are 4 mile radius is around 12, just 12 organic farms down the Bear Creek Valley. There's dots on the centers. There's also dots where the foreign corporation, who, by the way, cannot grow GMO crops in their own country, has chosen to come here to do it, has planted themselves across the street from organic producers, all right, in violation of their permit. Well, allegedly in violation of their permit. USDA makes that ruling, not me. But the point is, it's a narrow, tight valley. Coexistence is a difficult challenge in this environment. So the question is, what's the greatest good for the greatest number? We looked at the issue and decided that maybe we should go get some help. So, okay, that's enough of the map, I think, Barbara. First step, we went to USDA APHIS. What can we do here? This is not working out. They said, well, we issue permits, but we don't do enforcement or follow-up. If you're really upset, we can bring out a Bureau, BRS, Biotech Regulatory Services agent, and do an investigation. So they did. She came out. She took about, I think, 8 affidavits from farms, some of whom you received testimony from, Steve Fry, Fry Family Farms, Steve Goodley from Lakota's Farms, Abby Lane Farms, Glenn and Tom Ponder, took affidavits. Tom Ponder asked the investigators, that sugar beet plot across the street from me, sugar beet GMO plot? Sorry, sir, I can't disclose that. But she took the affidavit and she went off. Well, what about the investigation? Do you find out anything what happened? No, sir, that's non-disclosed. Can we get a Freedom of Information Act request to see the outcome of the investigation? No, sir, we won't give it to you. So, in effect, USDA APHIS said, well, you know, sorry, we're not going to do much. So where else can we go? Let's try the county. Let's try the state. Called up Dan Hilborn, ODA, Oregon Department of Agriculture, and says, Dan, there's a problem down here. What can we do? He said, well, ODA doesn't really get involved proactively in this. If y'all can get together and agree on a solution, we could help maybe set up a control district for you. But the issue is this. If you guys can't agree on what to do, nothing's going to happen because we don't get involved in disputes. You might talk about it for a while, but ultimately nothing would happen. So the state couldn't do anything for us. So we tried the county. Went to our county commissioner and said, look, this is a problem. What can we do? They looked at us straight in the eye and says, yep, you got a problem. And they looked over our shoulder and said, next. They didn't do anything or want to do anything. They were confused by the issue and said, well, we'll study it. So what do good citizens do in a situation like this? They get a petition going. All right? With the help of some volunteers, this is a volunteer group, by the way. This is not paid petitioners. We got 6,700 signatures, and last January qualified for the May 2014 ballot. And as a result, GMOs are a big issue in the Oregon legislature. To the point where some among us are saying, well, it should be a state issue. So anyway, I testified in Senate Bill 633 a couple weeks ago in opposition to that, and that's still an open item. But let me frame the problem as well. Okay, what kind of threat? You heard from Annie Hoy in written testimony. I think last night was submitted to you some statements by some of our local farmers. Steve Fry, Fry Family Farms, one of the larger organic growers in the county. He said that the GMO contamination next to him is costing him over $12,000 $1,500 a year in either lost seeds he can't sell, having to buy seeds to replace them, and foregone income. Chuck Burr, Restoration Seeds, destroyed $4,500 worth of organic beet seeds grown over the last 2 years. Don Tipping had to plow down $5,000 worth of beet seeds in Sal Escavel's own district, right there in Medford. The Ponders, Abbey Lane Farms. 12 years they've been organic growers. They stopped growing their own seeds for beet and chard because of there's a foreign corporation plot right across the street. So it's an important problem. And as Peter mentioned, it's an important part of our economy. He's giving those numbers. So what to do about it? We passed the law. I mean, we got the petition on the ballot. Haven't passed it yet. But to hear the opposition speak, you think we'd pass this in every county in the state. We haven't. What we're asking for, though, is some sort of legislative relief. One of the key issues about this is the Oregon Right to Farm Law. In the Senate Bill 633 hearing a couple weeks ago, John DiLorenzo said, and the support of his clients, said the counties can't afford this. The Right to Farm Law is going to allow us to sue you, and then you're going to have to pay us for our court costs. You can't afford it. All right. Well, what these bills here in front of you do, take that sword of Damocles off this issue. All right. 2715 is counties' clear authority to regulate GMOs. Let's see. 2319 actually puts the ODA in the middle of this. Instead of making ODA passive and non-reactive, they're being asked to actually get engaged in this and help settle the problem. And it also takes Oregon Right to Farm Law and makes it such that GMOs are no longer considered a commodity with respect to that law. That would help our measure, if successful, by the way, it hasn't passed yet, to be a viable law. And, of course, 2736 has to do with liability for inadvertent contamination. We would support that as well. But let's look at the Right to Farm Law. What does it say? Quite a bit of our time in bringing this out, like the city attorney of Ashland said, right to farm, you're preempted. But let's read it. It says, you know, if you're doing farming activities that are reasonable and prudent, you're protected. But is it reasonable and prudent when a foreign corporation is putting economic pressure on your local businesses? We don't think it is. All right, it also says that, you know, the right to farm precludes actions brought under the version of trespass or public nuisance, yet our initiative, you wrote, doesn't use trespass or initiative of trespass or public nuisance at all. You know, it's written in effect to avoid that. But still, it's vague. The original law was written to protect farms from suburban encroachment. All right, soccer moms are upset that their sons are getting dusted by a farmer next door in a boundary suburb, and you know, the law protects the farmers from that. It was never designed to settle farmer-to-farmer disputes. All right, who has a right to farm between a foreign corporation and an organic seed right? How do you resolve that with right to farm? You don't. We need help. These two of these bills in front of you would, in effect, do that. And I guess on precedence as well, in Umatilla County had a problem with organic apple growers and conventional apple growers. They decided they'd put out a county ordinance. It's passed. It's been there around. Been around for quite a while. But the Farm Bureau and Oregonians for Food and Shelter didn't seem to be upset about that. Jackson County, where I live, had a problem with abandoned pear orchards. You know, you get tired of farming, it's no longer economical, you leave your pear trees to rot, they become a source of pests. All right, and what do you do about it? Well, you pass a county ordinance to protect that part of your industry. And yet when we do it for GMOs, which again is no, pollen is technically in one sense no different than a foreign pest presence from your neighboring orchard. If you want something done about it, and try and do an initiative, a citizen's initiative, all of a sudden the sky is falling down. You can't do that. It's like, oh, it's unconstitutional. And things like that. So anyway, that's the issue. We would support all those three bills in front of us, and I'll close my comments with that. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Appreciate your testimony. Good morning. Welcome to our committee.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is Lorianne Bird, and I'm an attorney with the nonprofit public interest organization, the Center for Food Safety. CFS is a nationwide consumer and sustainable agriculture organization whose mission includes furthering the public's right to know how their food is produced and through labeling and other means. We have nearly 300,000 farmer and consumer members across the nation, including many in Oregon. We've worked on the issue of genetically engineered crops, GE labeling, and farmer protection for nearly two decades, both at the state and federal level. To that end, we've worked with dozens of states to help them craft bills pertaining to GE crops. I thank Chair Witt and the members of the committee for this opportunity to present testimony in support of HB 2715, 2319, and 2736, and I'll address each in turn. But as an initial matter, I just want to point out that these bills do not raise constitutional issues or otherwise conflict with any federal law. Although the Constitution empowers Congress to regulate interstate commerce, states may regulate articles in interstate commerce as long as they don't discriminate against out-of-state interests. None of these bills do that. I also should point out that I know you guys were talking about some of the labeling bills, and a well-crafted labeling bill does not need to interfere with interstate commerce and can be drafted in order to be protective against any constitutional challenges. HB 2715, 2319, and 2736 will not discriminate as they only propose to regulate interstate activities. Furthermore, even if this state bill, these state bills have an indirect effect on interstate commerce, they're still proper because the only time they might be improper is if they impose a burden that is clearly excessive in relation to their local benefits. Oregon has myriad interests in protecting the citizens' economic, health, and environmental interests, the right of its farmers to grow non-genetically engineered crops, and the consumer's right to choose to consume non-genetically engineered foods. These rights easily outweigh any burdens imposed by these bills. State or county safeguards, such as those in these bills, including planting limitations, monitoring programs that prevent the spread of genetically engineered material, and protections for farmers that are inadvertently contaminated by neighboring transgenetic crops, are a far cry from clearly excessive. In fact, I would urge anyone to come up with a less burdensome alternative to these bills. I am confident that you will not find one. Many states have passed Farmer Protection Acts, and I'll talk about some of those later. Other states and counties have also passed GE-related ordinances without incidents. In fact, there's never been a challenge to a state bill or county moratorium. Oregon right now has a law that regulates the growing of biopharmaceutical crops. This law has not been preempted or otherwise challenged. Similarly, these House bills are not unconstitutional or otherwise in conflict with federal law. First, I'll speak briefly about HB 2715, which establishes control areas for commodities containing transgenetic material. The management of local agricultural interests is an important and traditional role for counties. The Oregon Constitution and ORS 203.2035 grant the counties authority over matters of county concerns. The statute further dictates that this power should be liberally construed to the end that counties have all powers over matters of county concern that it is possible for them to have under the constitutions and laws of the United States and this state. HB 2715 authorizes counties to prohibit, limit, or condition the commercial or personal production of commodity GE crops based on the needs of individual counties. It allows counties to respond to their own local concerns. Counties are well situated to respond to the concerns of their residents regarding this issue and must be allowed to do so in order to protect their interests. Many counties of the nation have across the nation have decided to take action to more stringently regulate GE crops. These include Santa Cruz, Mendocino, Marin, and Trinity counties in California, Hawaii and Maui counties in Hawaii, and San Juan County in our neighbor to the north. These bills have successfully regulated GE crops at the countywide level and have not been subject to any extensive legal challenges. Similarly, HB 2715 will give county the authority to more stringently regulate GE crops, and I encourage your support of this bill to ensure that counties can continue to play their vital role in regulating their local affairs. Regarding HB 2319, which grants the State Department of Agriculture the authority to impose safeguards on the spread of transgenetic crops. These safeguards are critical to prevent the spread of unwanted transgenetic materials in Oregon. All this bill does is give farmers the right to request that the Oregon Department of Agriculture come and investigate when they raise concerns that genetically engineered material is interfering with their farming operation. Only if the state's investigation substantiates that farmer's concerns may the state impose restrictions on future plantings to protect that farmer. Gene flow from GE crops to conventional, organic, and wild plants, otherwise known as transgenetic contamination, can result from pollen drift, seed mixing, flooding, seeds and machinery, seed spillage, and a variety of natural events, such as the wind events that caused the spread of genetically engineered creeping bent grass in Oregon that I'll talk about in a moment. Farmers and researchers have documented contamination in a variety of crops, including but not limited to alfalfa, canola, rice, corn, and sugar beets. Once contamination exists, it is almost impossible to get rid of. A single incident of transgenetic contamination can cost farmers millions of dollars nationwide, and there have been incidents like that in the Southeast, where genetically engineered rice that was on field trials contaminated rice farmers and led to almost $1 billion in damages. Oregon is no stranger to genetic contamination, even from field trials when the crop is not approved for commercial production. In Oregon, genetically engineered creeping bentgrass escaped and traveled as far as 4 miles, crossing the Crooked River, crossing into our national grassland here in Oregon, causing contamination that persists to this day. For some Oregon farmers, as Brian mentioned, the risk of transgenetic contamination has already started to cause economic harm. One of our members has lost the majority of his chard crop, worth $18,000 a year, due to the threat of contamination from Roundup Ready sugar beets, which can cross-pollinate with chard. As GE crops continue to spread in Oregon, farmers may continue to expect to lose export markets and other clients due to the mere threat of contamination. HB 2319 could greatly help prevent the spread of transgenetic material and subsequently prevent the future risk of economic harm. Therefore, we encourage you to support this bill. And on to the final bill, which I'll discuss. HB 2736, the Oregon Farmer Protection Act, is an important farmer protection law for many reasons. And before I go into some of those in my oral testimony, I'll just point out that I've provided all of you with a copy of our report, Seed Science, Seed Giants versus U.S. Farmers, and I encourage you to take a look at that. Currently, 5 other states have seed protection acts similar to this one. These acts provide procedural protection to farmers when they are being investigated for patent infringement. The states that currently have these protections, which have not been challenged, again, I should mention, are North Dakota, California, Indiana, Vermont, and South Dakota. These state laws are necessary to prevent farmers. Since the enactment of South Dakota's law, only one lawsuit has been filed against a South Dakota farmer alleging patent infringement. In states without these protections, farmers are facing dozens of lawsuits. In Missouri alone, patent holders have filed 19 lawsuits against farmers. It is crucial that Oregon take these measures to protect its farmers, especially in light of the widespread adoption of recently approved Roundup Ready sugar beets. As you all know, our economy is dependent on the family farms that make up our backbone. Once planted, patented crops can spread throughout our environment as through the variety of means that I described above. The liability for this contamination is being unfairly passed from manufacturers to unknowing and innocent farmers. Conventional seeds, which are not genetically engineered, consistently test positive for patented material due to the uncontrolled movement of genetic traits. Farmers who grow crops with patented traits are often targeted with patent infringement actions, since saving seeds from those crops is illegal. Growers of patented plants who are mistakenly targeted for these investigations have a very difficult time defending their cases, and they deserve the opportunity to collect independent samples and be aware of investigations from day one, which is what this bill would provide. Patent holders investigate up to 500 farmers every year in the United States. Without this law, private investigators can arrive unexpectedly on a farmer's land, demand to be allowed in. Trespass? Take photos or crop samples, make threats, engage in harassment, or even engage in entrapment-like activities, and those are activities that have been reported to us by farmers. This bill prevents such unlawful and intrusive investigations by providing procedures for an open and honest crop investigation process and protects farmers from trespassing, harassment, and entrapment. These procedural protections are important because they deter patent holders from engaging in unlawful activities, and they provide patent holders with a legal framework to follow to help legitimize their complaints where they are legitimate. Patent holders will therefore have better access to farmers in their fields through this mandated framework. For some farmers, I just want to mention that these kinds of intrusions into their land can lead to very serious consequences, including litigation. As the report that you have shows, we've been studying this issue since 2003. As of November 28, 2012, just one patent holder, Monsanto Corporation, has filed 142 alleged patent infringement lawsuits involving 410 farmers and 56 small businesses in 27 states. For this reason, because this threat is so imminent, it is critical that any patent infringement lawsuit start with a fair and honest crop investigation to protect the rights of our farmers. This issue is currently pending before the Supreme Court. They heard oral arguments about a month ago. In that instance, Monsanto was prosecuting a 75-year-old farmer in Indiana who they alleged was unlawfully saving soybean seeds. The Farmer Protection Law does not remove any rights from patent holders. Instead, it honors the rights of patent holders, but simultaneously protects and respects the rights of Oregon farmers. Oregon has a rich history of protecting our state's interests in agriculture. These bills will protect public health, the public's right to know, our agricultural economy, the health of our environment, and our native ecosystems. For the reasons stated above, I encourage you to support these bills. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm happy to answer any follow-up questions or provide additional analysis.
Thank you very, very much. Appreciate your very in-depth testimony. Are there questions, committee members, for this panel? Ms. Byrd, you mentioned just a moment ago patent infringements filed by Monsanto, and it was a large number. I didn't get the exact number.
142 lawsuits involving 410 farmers, 56 small farm businesses in 27 states.
Did you mention settlements?
No.
Okay. I'll take the liberty here.
Would you please identify yourself?
Brian Combs again.
Thank you.
I'll take the liberty. Well, that's 145 lawsuits, and that's documented on Monsanto's website. You can look it up.
Okay.
All right. But Center for Food Safety also put out another report about something called settlements. Those are settlements out of court and never get to a lawsuit stage. And I believe the report, which is from 2007, I think it was, so there's over 5,000 settlements. And that, again, that's gathered from Monsanto public records. So, you know, just you may not have a court when you can't settle out, but there's a lot of activity on this. All right. So it's more than just 145 lawsuits. Because right. I think Dr. Carol Mallory Smith, well, it's only 70 a year for 20 years. That's not a lot, she said. But there's thousands of settlements.
All right. Thank you very, very much. Anything further? Appreciate your testimony very much.
Thank you very much.
Is there anyone else who's wishing to testify on these bills that's come from a considerable distance, say greater than 100 miles at this point? Sir, would you care to testify now? Anyone else? Okay, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome.
Thank you. Chairman Witt, members of the Agriculture Committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Martin Richards. My family operates an irrigated farm in Central Oregon's High Desert. We grow hybrid carrot seed, Kentucky bluegrass seed, peppermint oil, hay, and grain on our 600-acre irrigated acres. In a typical year, we devote 80 to 100 acres to growing alfalfa for livestock feed. We added Roundup Ready alfalfa to our crop rotation when the seed became available in 2006. The addition of a genetically engineered crop to our rotation has only increased our profitability and has made our farm a safer place to work and live. We use significantly less herbicides, and herbicides we use are less toxic. The risk of herbicide drift or residue impacting adjoining crops, neighboring farms, private property, wildlife habitat, and future crops have been greatly reduced. Because we were raising seed crops, we have cultural practices in place to prevent the contamination of adjoining crops and the prevention of so-called superweeds. These cultural practices are easily adapted to the GE crop and are actually easier to implement. Our crops are more consistent, weed-free, and higher value. We reduced our tillage needs, cutting fuel consumption and emissions, conserving crop residue, and reducing soil erosion. The ability to add Roundup Ready alfalfa to our crop rotation has made our farm safer. It's also reduced the impact our farming practices have on the environment. In regards to House Bill 2319 and 2715, while one bill focuses on the ODA and one on counties, these two bills will have similar consequences of adding complexity and uncertainty to the regulatory process for GE crops, ultimately discouraging research and development of new beneficial technologies and preventing Oregon farmers from having access to safe, environmentally friendly, and economically beneficial crop varieties. Research and development of new technology is only feasible when a predictable regulatory process is in place that creates a path from investment to commercialization for safe, beneficial products. USDA and EPA already rigorously evaluate new GE crops to ensure that they don't pose any plant pest or environmental risks before they can be approved for use. The U.S. regulatory process for biotechnology is considered a gold standard internationally. These bills would only serve to undermine the credibility and predictability of that process and add an additional layer of regulation that would be costly, unpredictable, and not scientifically or economically justified. GE crops do not present any new or novel risks for farmers and the agricultural industry. There are a number of cultural and management practices that have been developed to help farmers maintain the purity and integrity of specialty crops. There is no justification for singling out GE crops. Any safeguards, growing restrictions, or regulatory requirements should be based on real scientifically validated risks. In regards to House Bill 2736, this bill is unnecessary and perpetuates a common misconception about patent restrictions on GE crops. Registration requirements would prove costly and burdensome for farmers and would discourage the adoption of safe, environmentally friendly crops and production practices. It is an unfortunate misconception that farmers may be liable for inadvertent presence and use of GE crops. There have been no cases of biotech companies suing growers for unintentional presence of biotech material in their crop due, for example, to cross-pollination. Lawsuits have only involved intentional, known violations of patent restrictions. The vast majority of farmers are happy to comply with patent laws and respect intellectual property rights because they understand the need to preserve the incentives that drive research and investment in new beneficial technologies. Requiring farmers to register with the ODA to plant GE crops would be costly and burdensome requirement for farmers that would ultimately discourage the adoption of safe, environmentally friendly, and economically beneficial technologies and production practices. Moreover, mandatory registration creates privacy concerns for many farmers. There is no scientific or economic justification for targeting GE crops once USDA and EPA has determined that they are safe for commercial use and pose no more health or environmental risks as any other crops in use today. I'm looking forward to our son moving his family home next week to join us on the farm. I would not choose to produce crops that I thought would put the health of my young grandson at risk. I have confidence in the testing and controls that are in place today. I trust the scientific evidence that has shown over and over that these crops are healthy and safe to grow and consume. I oppose these bills because I believe they would harm my family financially, adversely affect the economy of my community, limit our ability to feed the world, and remove tools that currently enable us to create a safer environment for our employees, neighbors, and friends. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments? Vice Chair McEwen?
Yes, Chair Witt, thank you. Sir, could you detail for me maybe a couple of examples of practices that you have to put in place when you're growing two different crops that you need to keep separate? How onerous is that? What practices do you use to eliminate the possibility of contamination?
In the case of hybrid carrot seed, Jefferson County, where I live, grows 80% of the world's hybrid carrot seed, and cross-pollination is critical. I mean, it's critical to eliminate cross-pollination. We have a district that's regulated by the growers that every year before planting, the growers get together. They work at identifying where they want to plant and that there is distances between each grower so that there wouldn't be any risk of cross-pollination.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to call up, please, Kathy Boone. Good morning.
Good morning, Chairman Witt and committee. Thank you for hearing my testimony today, and I do apologize in advance for my tardiness. And I'd like to address House Bill 2736. Also, I am here on behalf of GMO-Free Oregon. And I would like to say that I believe that this is important. If this bill is passed, that it will protect the farmers' intellectual property or contractual rights concerning the use of genetically engineered plants and will exempt farmers from liability for GMO contamination. And I do urge the passing of this bill because GE crops are a very real risk for non-GMO crops. GMO crops can contaminate neighboring crops very easily. Once these seed stuffs are out into nature, it is very difficult to control where it goes, and the contamination of GMO crops to non-GMO crops cannot be reversed. Planting genetically engineered life forms and products is not a reasonable and prudent farm practice because of genetic drift from windborne and insect-carried pollens from one farm can create economic harm to farmers who have chosen to farm without them. The state of Oregon recognizes that Oregon organic farmers and farms make a vital and important contribution to its economy, improve the state's agricultural viability, and increases the Oregon consumers' local food choices. Also, I'd like to state that it's important because regulations of GE crops are non-existent in Oregon. The current government regulations at the federal level are weak at best, and the Oregon farmer must be protected because of biotech companies such as GMO giants Monsanto, who own 90% of the patents, the seed patents in the United States, are devoted to investigating and prosecuting farmers who they believe have committed patent infringement. Thank you for your time, and I certainly appreciate your support regarding this bill. And if you have any questions, I can answer them.
Thank you very, very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Any questions? I'm not seeing any. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You wowed the whole community committee. Thank you. Once again, is there anyone who's come into the hearing room who's come from a long distance, more than 100 miles today? Not seeing anyone. Okay, thank you. I'd like to call up next, please, Dr. Steve Strauss and Barry Bashu. Good morning and welcome to both of you.
Thank you very much, Chairman Witt, committee members, other attendees. My name's Steve Strauss. I'm a distinguished professor of forest biotechnology at Oregon State. I'm a member of the university program in molecular and cellular biology and director of an OSU program called Outreach in Biotechnology that seeks to educate the public about the very issues we're talking about today. I also conduct research on genetics of poplar trees in Oregon, fiber and energy crop. With my toxicologist colleague, Dave Stone, I've taught about GMO and toxicology issues at OSU for about 10 years. As part of my job as director of the outreach program, I've hosted 40 top scholars at OSU over the last 8 years who've given public lectures on GMOs and related issues. They're all available on our website. Speakers have ranged from historians to political scientists to economists to ecologists as well as geneticists. And I tell you this because I want you to know that I think I know these issues, both the science and the broader context, pretty well. I'm opposed to House Bills 2319, 2715, and 2736 for three reasons. First, I believe they're based on poor science, which I'll come back to in a minute. Second, I believe they are fundamentally undemocratic in trying to limit choices in farming, seeking to impose one farming system and attendant sets of beliefs upon others. And third, because by imposing local regulations, many of which, to me at least, I'm not a lawyer, but they appear to contradict federal regulations, they will increase costs and may create havoc in farming communities, the marketplace, and the courtroom. HB 2319 seeks to prevent the spread of any GMO materials, either viable pollen and seed or inviable geneless products, in the environment when it is, quote, interfering with or may interfere, unquote, with non-GMO farming practices. It does not specify what interfering might mean. I guess this is to be figured out by the lawyers. That should be fun. It also does not specify what level of spread is problematic. In other words, any spread, even a few pollen grains among trillions, could be a violation. This is not realistic for agriculture, and I'll come back to that a little bit later. It also sets up a system where the state of Oregon would, in effect, support the view that GMOs are simply bad and to be avoided. Yet there is abundant data from all over the world that use of GMOs can have large benefits, have had large benefits in many crop systems. This has been shown many times when considered in terms of yields, economic benefits for the public and farmers, and environmental impacts. A recent economist who spoke in my lecture series, an economist who spoke recently in my lecture series, said that the economic benefits of GMO crops have been about $70 billion through 2010, and most of it flows to the public, not to corporations. The National Research Council issued a report in 2010 about the sustainability impacts of GMO crops in the USA. One of the committee members on that report, an ecologist, was in our lecture series last June, and he said they found large environmental benefits due to pesticide reductions and increases of no and low-till farming. However, he also said that the management of herbicide-tolerant GMO crops was exacerbating the development of weeds that are resistant to herbicides, something we'd like to avoid. However, he pointed out that is not unique to GMOs, as it has happened hundreds of times prior to their use. In contrast with a different system, for insect-resistant GMO crops, they've done a good job of resistance management. The bottom line is that the report suggested large benefits and more prudence in management, not any kind of a ban or prohibition. The bills and their treatment of GMOs suggest they are something novel and radical. This is no longer true. Since 1996, they have now been grown on billions of acres in about two dozen countries throughout the world. It is fully mainstream in many places, and including much of the USA. As I said earlier, the bill ignores the fact that all types of farming result in spreading of materials between different types of farms and lands. That is not unique to GMOs. Farmers and local governments have created systems for coexistence where seed and produce purity is maintained at levels that are workable by all parties. I spoke at a USDA-supported workshop in Washington in 2011 that summarized these systems and their successful function in the USA. The link is in the written testimony I provided. The demand for zero spread is not workable, nor does it make sense given the record of GMO benefits to date and the growing benefits that are expected as the science goes forward. HB 2175 seeks to allow counties to establish control areas for GMO crops, but would not allow control areas for biopharma GMO crops. HB 2736 seeks to prohibit any growing of a biopharma crop outside of a greenhouse or a laboratory, nor in any crop plant used for food or feed. I served on a statewide committee on biofarm crops from 2005 to 2006 that was convened by the Oregon Department of Agriculture and the Oregon Department of Human Services. The committee recommended, quote, endorsement moderate scope to indicate that it supports wisely chosen and carefully studied applications of biofarm technology in Oregon. However, it also recommended caution with biofarm food and feed crops grown out of doors, and its recommendations led to a new rule, 561.740, that permits the ODA to enter into an MOA with USDA, sorry, too many acronyms there, to ensure a full review is conducted with Oregon's best local interests in mind. A complete ban was not recommended, which I think is wise in that biofarm crops could have large benefits by enabling safer and lower cost production of antibodies, enzymes, and vaccines to treat devastating diseases. In fact, the research is in that it is successful doing that. It can be successful doing that. Those applications are still developing. And many of these biofarm products would in fact be harmless even if there was some admixture with other crops. But the bottom line is that Oregon has already considered this issue in depth and come up with a prudent policy. It does not need a ban that would foreclose all business and scientific development in this potentially important area. So in sum, whether considered from science or policy perspectives, these bills seem unwise to me. They cater to the special interests of a small segment of the farming community and public and are technologically regressive rather than progressive. Thank you very much for considering my views.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Chair Witt and members of the committee, my name is Barry Bashu. My wife and I raise a variety of specialty crops for retail and wholesale using many different agricultural practices. I'm honored to serve as Oregon Farm Bureau President and Vice President of the American Farm Bureau. I was appointed by U.S. Secretary Vilsack to serve on the Agriculture and Biotechnology in the 21st Century Committee, and I also currently serve on a national industry accord to help develop protocols to deal with biotech traits as they come off patent. I'm here to testify against HB 2319, 2715, and 2736. I continue to be amazed by the plethora of bills asking this legislative body to create a preference for one type of agriculture over another. It is unfortunate and short-sighted. We will need all of agriculture to feed a growing world population. We will need to produce more food in the next 40 years than we have in the last 500. To do that, we will need to embrace all methods and technologies that are available to us. Organic agriculture is a tremendous success story, but still accounts for only 0.6% of all croplands in the United States and less than 4% of total food sales. Each of these bills imposes threats to farmers and safe and proven production methods. Unbelievably, House Bill 2319 declares that GM crops are not a farming practice. I wonder what message that sends to those farmers in this very room and elsewhere, to those who work hard every day to plant and harvest these crops. GM corn, soybeans, alfalfa, and sugar dominate the market, and yet we won't consider them agriculture. What is next? It is disingenuous to couch this as foreign corporations versus farmers. More than 17 million farmers worldwide raise GM crops. What are they doing if they're not farming? Every major medical, health, and science organization in the United States has declared these products safe, and in some cases safer than non-GE crops. The most recent comprehensive research completed by the European Commission came to that same conclusion. These crops undergo intensive, costly, long-term study and testing to meet the rigid requirements established by USDA and FDA in order to be approved. House Bill 2715 would usurp the science and give the authority to already cash-strapped counties to oversee and regulate legal, safe products. Imagine trying to farm in more than one county. Imagine pitting one farmer against another because of this legislation. Is that really the best use of legislative authority? Is it really good public policy? House Bill 2736 is equally unnecessary and egregious. These crops are undoubtedly the most regulated and studied. They create no more of a challenge amongst neighbors than any other. They are no different than blue corn, white corn, or bicolor corn. Farmers have coexisted for generations. It requires farmers to work together, and certainly isn't as easy as passing a law to harm your neighbors, but it is critical. Technology hasn't changed any of that. Different varieties of corn can be grown with buffers of 30 inches based on planting dates. San Juan County passed its ban because there were no farmers there to engage in the issue. In Mendocino County, there were no GM farmers, so no legal standing to engage. No farmer has ever lost organic certification as a result of adventitious presence. No seed company has ever brought suit for the adventitious presence of a GE trait. The suits referred to earlier are for breach of contract and usurping of patent law. In a year and a half of studies, panels, and experts, the AC21 committee made up of the Organic Trade Association, GM-free, and conventional farmers and other organizations was unable to discover a single farmer who had suffered a compensable loss as a result of adventitious presence. Without this kind of hard data, the committee recommended to the Secretary of Agriculture that he attempt to gather such data before he embarked on developing a compensation or liability mechanism. Recommendations for any mechanism, if deemed necessary, were in the form of crop insurance. An indemnity fund paid for by seed companies warranted a lot of discussion, but were not part of the recommendations. The challenge of holding a seed producer liable for their seed after it is planted by a private farmer under strict contractual and stewardship agreements was unreasonable and capricious. I would urge you to await the outcome of the USDA efforts on this issue. They have the resources and the expertise to accomplish this at no cost to the state. Thank you for your opportunity to testify. I strongly urge you to oppose these bills and be welcome to take any questions.
Thank you very, very much. Questions for the panel? Yes.
Just curious, are any organic farmers members of the Farm Bureau?
Yes, in fact, two of them are on our board of directors.
Thank you.
Anyone else? I'm wondering if you could give us an idea of the agricultural crops that are commonly found in the typical American diet on a regular basis, genetically modified.
Corn, soybeans, papaya, if you eat papaya. Sugar, obviously sugar, because the majority of sugar in the world is now raised with sugar beets, and the majority of those. In fact, I believe that I want to say over 80%, certainly over 90% of all the corn raised, almost 90% of all the soybeans raised. And if you look downwind at all those crops and all those food products that derive from those, I think it's over 70% of all foods in the U.S. have some form of GM presence.
And I recognize that some of these crops may have been genetically modified earlier than others, but on average, have we been consuming these foods for 15 to 16 years.
It was interesting, if I may, Chair Witt, members of the committee, a number of years ago, one of the first traits, GM traits, was for a potato, and it was in Maine. And it was interesting, at that time, the only folks who rolled up to testify in favor of the regulation of that trait and the approval of that trait were the Maine Organic Growers Association. But interestingly enough, it was for a pesticide trait because they were looking for opportunities to reduce the application of pesticides. A number of years later, when USDA and FDA determined that since there was a pesticide trait inherent in that plant, it would have to be regulated by pesticide regulations under EPA, all of a sudden the same folks that were for that trait all of a sudden decided they couldn't be for it any longer because it would be declared a pesticide. Somewhat hypocritical, in my opinion.
All right. Anything further? Yes, Representative Thompson?
So, what, I mean, you seem to have a lot of experience in that background in this. What is the genesis of the fear toward GMO? I mean, I used to do some of this work, and if you want to put the effort into it, Mendelian genetics will get you to the same place 100 years from now. That GMO has gotten its benefits shorter term. Why are we having this continued discussion about how awful GMO is when the benefits seem to indicate otherwise?
Yeah, we in the course we teach, we always have a session on risk perception. And two things that come up. One is that the benefits have mainly been to farmers. The consumers don't see them directly. Even though there have been price reductions, they've been statistical. They're very large in terms of the $70 billion I mentioned earlier. But you as a consumer wouldn't see that in the store, and it wouldn't be a significant factor. So the benefits to farmers, companies, risk to you is perceived. So that's not a good equation. And secondly, you can't see it. So it's an unknown risk. It's a risk that if by some chance things were wrong and it was toxic and it's in all of our food, it could cause a catastrophic problem. So there's a thing called dread risk that people who talk about this think about. And GMOs have that because they're invisible. You don't taste them. You don't see them. So if you're afraid of them, it can be a catastrophic kind of fear. So I think those are probably the two main issues.
Thank you. Representative Reardon?
I'm just trying to really simplify this and overly simplify it because I wasn't really good in my science classes. So this really seems to be, is it safe to say that this is really kind of a marketing and perception problem? Is that an oversimplification that it's really, there are those folks that think GMOs are just fine or they're going to save our planet and feed millions more people, and there's another group that just says we don't want that. Don't want it in our foods. We need to keep it separate. Is it really that simple? Is that what we're trying to manage?
Chair Witt, Representative Reardon, I would say that there is a piece of that. I think if you look at farmers in general, there are farmers who believe that what they grow is the most important thing to them and to the consumer. There are people who are absolutely committed to organic agriculture. They do a good job. They work very, very hard, and it's a challenge to raise any crop no matter how you do it. There are also those folks who see a huge marketing advantage for dispelling dispensing negative stuff against GM crops. There's a huge market advantage and huge margins for those folks that are able to characterize their product as vastly superior. I think there's some of that, so it does become a marketing issue. I think there are other people who are, frankly, American agriculture has been unbelievably successful. And in some ways, this is a victim of our success. No other country in the world has the luxury of the food choices that we have. And so, when you look at what happens in the marketplace, it's easy to talk about something negative, about something you really don't know much about. I think it's driven by fear a lot of times. I don't want to discount the motivations of those folks who absolutely are convinced that their form of agriculture is the best. God bless them, but don't let them have an impact on the fact that the crops that many of the rest of us raise are just as important to us and maybe more important to the consumer because of our ability to produce, far more food than that.
Thank you. Representative Unger.
Thanks, Chair Witt. Thanks for your testimony. The local control issues are interesting to me. Are there examples of other kinds of crops or species that local governments have made the decision that this shouldn't be allowed to be grown in their communities, or is this unique in that kind of debate and regulation?
I believe that it's unique. I am unaware of any other local ordinances that determine what you can and can't grow. There are certainly opportunities for the Department of Agriculture to deal with pest and disease issues, which is a whole separate issue from GM. GM is not a pest issue. It's not a disease issue. It's just another form of seed. So I guess a simple answer to the question, Chair Witt and Representative Unger, is no, I'm unaware of any.
Anything further? Not seeing anything. Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Appreciate your testimony. Next, I'd like to call up, please, Scott Setnix and Gil Riddell. And gentlemen, if you could do this 3 minutes apiece, I would really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me, I'll do my best. Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. We see this, I'm going to address House Bill 2715 only, and we see this as a matter of governance, strictly a matter of governance. In spite of our bedrock principles in support of local governance, counties aren't, counties are practical, they're not academically orthodox. And county officials know that we don't have the expertise, the experience, the resources, or the staff to carry this responsibility. There will be lawsuits against counties who try this, whether they do anything or not. And we understand there's a constitutional question that's being determined by legislative council. The expertise lies in the state, at the state and federal levels. AOC supports Senate Bill 633, which would reserve to the state the authority over these matters. This would conflict with that, so we are opposed to House Bill 2715. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Scott Setnicker. I'm a farmer here at Farm and Independence, just across the bridge. I'm an Oregon State crop science grad. I graduated in 2004. Currently, I'm the chair of the Processed Vegetables Commission. Here, we're representing all the processed vegetable growers in Oregon. A little bit of information about our farm. We grow about 10 different crops, over 5,500 acres. We actually have some organic production. I have 45 acres that's certified organic that we farm. Mostly, the only crops I'm going to focus on today is just our corn production. Last year, well, depending on the season, we produce 600 to 800 acres of sweet corn. That equates to 15 to 20 million pounds of processed corn. And 42 acres of that is processed sweet corn for organic production. And also on our farm, we produce field corn, 300 to 600 acres, depending on the year for crop rotation, which equates to 3 to 6 million pounds of dried grain, which will be then sold to livestock feed in the dairy industry, to Tillamook or to Harrisburg, to the St. Barb State's mill. And of that production of field corn we raise, roughly 75% of that is GMO traded field corn. A little bit of statistics nationally, 90% of the corn grown in the United States is genetically modified. So you think of all the corn that's being grown across the United States, Corn Belt, North Dakota, South Dakota, all the way down into the South. 90% of that is all genetically modified. A little bit of a life cycle history of or how the corn plant works. Okay, so when can the genetically modified traits spread from field to field? When the corn tassel comes out of the plant, at the same time on the ear, the silks are coming out. And there's about a week time frame when the tassel on the top of the corn releases the pollen, and it actually has to come down and touch each silk inside the ear. And when the silk is pollinated, it will make a fertilized kernel. So when you pick an ear of sweet corn at the grocery store, pull it apart, all those silks were pollinated from the tassel. And the only time the pollen can flow is while that if there's a they say that the first 3 to 4 days after the tassel emerges is when the pollen can be released. But there's about a 2 week period there that there's potential for cross pollination. And why I describe that is because, like I said earlier, we grow sweet corn and field corn. And it's a very critical issue that we keep the pollen from sweet corn that separate from the GMO field corn and other types of sweet corn. So I got this sheet right here, if you guys want to look at it. This is from the NORPAC, which is a large food processor here in Oregon, that we're members of the co-op. This is what we use when we're planting our sweet corn. And if you notice, there's all different types of corn. There's SU sweet corn, SE sweet corn, SH2, and white. Those are four different types of sweet corn that we grow. And if I plant an SU field next to an SH2, which is super sweet, I still have to have an isolation from other types of sweet corn. So it's not just an issue of GMO. It's cross-pollination can happen between all different types of crops. And like you said earlier, I could actually plant my sweet corn right next to my field corn. What it would take is a 4 week planting time difference, or what the cannery requires is if I have a field corn field planted next to sweet corn, I have to wait 4 weeks between planting so that the tassel timing is off, and then there's no risk of cross-pollination.
Could you please wrap up?
I'm trying.
Thank you. I'm trying
to cover this for all the growers here. So going to field corn, I have two charts I handed you guys. This is Pioneer Hybrids. This is Mycogen Seeds. These are two of the big seed corn companies that I grow for. So when I go to select a hybrid, I have to pick a certain day length of corn. So in here in the Willamette Valley, we grow 79-day to 90-day corn. And on this chart, if you look down through it in the traded section, you'll find that there's not one conventional variety that's available on either of these companies in the day length of corn that we're growing here in the Willamette Valley. So what have I had to do to find my conventional varieties? I've had to hunt around seed companies all over the United States to find a conventional field corn variety to grow in the Willamette Valley here for the day length we grow. So this is a very important issue to all corn producers in the Willamette Valley, both sweet corn and field corn growers. They touched on the stewardship program that is required to grow a GMO crop. Whenever I plant Roundup Ready, BT, depending on the variety, I have to sign a stewardship agreement. And what that stewardship agreement tells me I have to do, depending on the variety of GMO corn, if it's Roundup Ready, I don't have to do anything other than I can't save the seed. But if it's a BT hybrid, which means it has an insecticide trait built into the seed, I have to follow specific requirements that's set forth by the USDA. And if you look on this chart, there's different hybrids. Some require a 20% refuge, some require a 5% refuge. And that means that I have to plant a non-traded corn in the same field to meet the requirements that the USDA requires. And I can be audited at any time by the federal government. They'll come in, a USDA can audit me, and I have to keep my records for like 5 years of my seed purchases. One other thing real quick, on our farm we've invested about $300,000 just this season in a new drying facility to dry our field corn. And like I said, it is almost impossible to find a conventional variety. So this bill puts my investment at risk. Let's see. So I guess, wrapping up, I oppose all these bills, and I think the GMOs need to be regulated on the federal level.
Scott, you put across a great deal of information in a very short period of time, and I know that I forced you to hurry up. I apologize, but great job. Thank you very much. And Gil, thank you as well. Committee members, with that, I'm going to hold questions because we're going to carry this hearing over. I'm going to announce that we're carrying over the public hearing on House Bills 2319, 2715, and 2736 to March 28th. And with that, I close the public hearing. I close today's public hearing on House Bills 2319, 2715, and 2736. I'm going to reopen a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2783. And with that, I announce that I am going to carry over a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2783. And I now close the public hearing and work session. Oh, I'm going to carry that over until March 28th. And I'm now going to announce that I close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 2783. Thank you, committee members, very much. We got through a very extensive agenda here. And we are adjourned. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Chair Witt.